is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll learn why baby boomers may need to be tested for hepatitis C, plus how telephone weight loss coaching can actually prevent diabetes. But first, a visit with a registered nurse who's planning a medical mission to Ghana and what she hopes to accomplish. Well, many of us have heard of the high-profile humanitarian organization Doctors Without Borders, made up of doctors and nurses who volunteer to provide urgent medical care to victims of war and disasters in countries throughout the world. But less well-known are the homegrown medical humanitarian efforts taking place right here in Central New York. And here to tell us all about it is Lori Ruprecht, a pediatric registered nurse with the Center for Development, Behavior, and Genetics at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Lori. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So I understand you're organizing a medical mission to Ghana, of all places. Tell us about it.
Okay, I've been to Ghana myself 3 times on medical missions. The first 2 times I went on individual missions. The third time I decided to take a group with me, and we had a 13-volunteer team that went to Ghana and went out to the remote villages and set up temporary medical stations, and basically we were there for 2 weeks, and we served 1,470 people
wow.
in those villages.
That was the last time when you went with the group.
Correct, yes.
What prompted you to decide to, even the first time, to go to Ghana, or to even go to do this kind of work? What was the motivating factor?
You know, it's something that I just always have wanted to do. As a child, watching TV and seeing the children from Africa, you know, the starving children from Africa, I said, one day I'm going to go there and help them. And so a couple of years ago, 2010, my children were older, and I decided, I'm getting older. If I'm going to do this, I better do it. So I researched. I found an organization in Ghana to partner with, and started doing the trips. I went the first time, fell in love with the country, fell in love with the people, and then I wanted to share it with others, so I organized a group.
So just to get this clear, the first 2 times you went as a nurse.
Correct.
And you did some of the same things? You set up medical stations in remote places?
No. That was the very first project of its kind that
this third time that you went?
Yes. Okay. The first time I went with another LPN, and we worked in a rural medical clinic, and we did a lot of mother-child outreach kind of things. The second time I went by myself, and I went to an orphanage and worked in an orphanage for 2 weeks.
Why did you choose Ghana?
I chose Ghana because, for a couple of reasons, because it's generally a safe country, it's a democratic country, it's peaceful, but they also have a lot of needs. There's a lot of poverty, and there's also a lot of potential in that country to better themselves.
So you founded an organization. Tell us about that. The ASAP.
Yes, it's American Serving Abroad Project. That's the name of my groups that I am bringing to Ghana. And I partner with another organization based right in Ghana called El Ghana. And that is run by native Ghanaians, which is important because to partner with an organization directly in the country, they know exactly what the communities need. So they actually arrange for the projects, arrange for the transportation, the accommodations, all of that for us. And I make the arrangements on this end with flights and transportation to the country and preparing the people to go, that type of thing.
So tell us a little bit more about your last trip. You just said you were there with a group. How big a group of people did you bring?
There was 13 of us. Several of them were nurses here at Upstate. There was one medical student, and a couple other people who just had a desire to go and help others less fortunate. And
you were there for 2 weeks.
We were there for
2 weeks.
And
you saw almost 1,500 people?
Correct.
Oh, my goodness.
So we averaged, and we didn't go to villages every day. We also did other things like some sightseeing, cultural kind of things. So actually, when we were working, we averaged 250 people a day that we saw and treated.
Wow. 13 people. Yeah. That's really amazing. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. I'm here with Lori Ruprecht. She's a pediatric registered nurse, and we're talking about actually her past humanitarian mission to Ghana and an upcoming one. So you're trying to organize another group such as that.
Correct.
Tell us about that.
So the
What's the mission for this new?
It's going to be the same model. It's going to be a mobile medical mission. Again, we'll be going out to remote villages, different ones this time. And I'm hoping to recruit some additional professionals like a physician or a nurse practitioner, an audiologist, ophthalmologist, dentist or dental hygienist to go with us, as well as anyone else who has a desire to go.
So you needn't necessarily be trained in medical care.
You don't need any kind of special skills to go, just the desire. We're going to have a lot of different roles. One of the new goals that we're going to have is to also sign people up for the National Health Insurance Plan.
You mean in Ghana?
Yes.
Help people become registered.
Yes, while we're in the villages, because a lot of them aren't registered.
So besides basic health care, you were also, sounds like you were doing mother-infant or mother-child work in some way?
That's an interest of mine. I focused on that the first time I went to Ghana, and I was fortunate at that time they were doing the mass polio vaccination campaign. So we went around to villages, schools, markets, and vaccinated any child that we found. We marked their pinkies with a black indelible marker, and that's how we knew if they had been vaccinated previously.
Wow. I bet that was very gratifying
to participate really was.
In something.
And that's
like
the great thing about this project is that it's a mutually beneficial project. It's not only the people that we serve that benefit, it's also the volunteers. And it's not only the project itself, it's also maybe even more so the human interaction, the cultural exchange that occurs between all of the people involved.
Right.
That's most valuable and rewarding.
So help us understand, you're looking for volunteers right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have a link on our website about contacting you to find out more about it. Our website is HealthLink on Air. That's one word, healthlinkonair.org. But tell us a little bit more about the trip or the concept. It's going to be for how long? How long will people be gone for?
The next trip I'm planning for 10 days, a 10-day trip. It's going to be the end of February to the beginning of March.
How long is the trip? Meaning, how long does it take?
The flight from JFK, we take a direct flight from JFK to Accra, Ghana, and it's about 11 to 12-hour flight.
And what's it like when you're there? I mean, what are the living conditions like? I think people have all kinds of images of what it's like to live in Africa, especially in perhaps a less developed area.
Yes. So the cities are much different than the rural areas. And the rural areas are pretty much like what people would probably think of Africa as being. The people, they really have nothing. As far as
is there running
material,
water?
Sometimes there's running water, sometimes there's not. Sometimes there's electricity, sometimes there's not.
What kind of, you know, domiciles are they in? Like mud huts? What type?
So it depends on the village that you're in. Some are mud huts, some are stick homes. There's a wide variety of.
But you and your volunteers would basically situate yourselves in the city and then take trips out to these rural villages, or you live in the villages?
We live in a village. Typically what would happen is they would get us a guest home in one of the maybe larger villages. Then we would travel out a couple of hours out into the communities each day.
Are there any preparations? I mean, first let me ask you, is there an age level that you're looking for or an age range?
No, any age.
Really?
Yep.
That doesn't include teenagers, though, I would think.
Probably not.
Mm-hmm. So adults.
Adults, yes.
Mm-hmm. And do you need special preparations? Does someone have to get special vaccinations or that type of thing?
There are vaccinations that you need. We go to the travel clinic and they advise us on what vaccinations are needed. You need yellow fever for sure to get into the country. And there's probably a couple other ones that people generally need before they go.
What do you think some of the biggest challenges have been already in what you've done?
The biggest challenges probably carrying all of the supplies with us to the country. It was kind of pretty difficult. So this time we're going to try to procure more supplies in the country itself once we get there, of the supplies that we can do get there.
And specifically, what do you see as your goals for this particular upcoming trip? You mentioned vaccination as one goal on an earlier trip. Mm-hmm. Is there any particular goal that you said having people signed up for the
correct
their
that's
National
an, that's
Health
an,
Service?
Yes, that will be a new service that we're going to do, because that's what we found this last time, is that a lot of people weren't signed up. So if we had referred them, we found they were had hypertension and needed to seek medical care. They didn't have the insurance to be able to go and get that medical care for free, and they don't have the money.
In a little bit of time we have left, I just mm-hmm. want to ask you, so you as a pediatric nurse, are you going and basically looking at adults and making diagnoses of what their medical needs are, or do you have someone who is a trained physician, for example, helping you as well?
We didn't have a trained physician this past time. Like I said, I'm hoping to have one the next time, so we don't make diagnosis. It's a lot of screening, a lot of teaching. We were able to pick up on a lot of medical issues such as hypertension.
So what's the best part if you were trying to sell this to people as to why to go? Why would you want to go?
It's really the human interaction, the cultural exchange that occurs. Like I said, you come back with a brand new perception on life, really.
Well, I want to thank you so much. I really applaud your efforts. It's very, very impressive and inspiring. My guest has been Lori Ruprecht, a pediatric registered nurse with the Center for Development, Behavior, and Genetics at Upstate Medical University. Why baby boomers may be at risk for hepatitis C. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Back to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Did you know that 1 in 30 baby boomers, that's the generation born between 1945 and 65, has been infected with hepatitis C? And most don't even know it. Well, the Centers for Disease Control has recently recommended hepatitis C testing for all baby boomers. And joining us this morning to help us understand this recommendation are Dr. David Parr. He's the Associate Professor of Medicine specializing in infectious diseases, and he's also the Medical Director of the Designated AIDS Center here at Upstate. And along with him, he is Broad Kelly Flood. She is a social worker, and she's the Assistant Program Director for the Designated AIDS Center here at Upstate. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Before we go on to the Hep C recommendation, what's the relationship here with Hep C and your AIDS clinic? I mean,
well, Linda, in the United States, and actually most of the developed world, about 30% of people who have HIV also have hepatitis C, and that's because the diseases are spread similarly. So we see both HIV and Hep C patients in our clinic co-infected.
So your AIDS clinic, I know here at Upstate, really sees a lot of people, up to 1,000 people currently, servicing
Correct.
Them
yes.
for all kinds of issues having to do with AIDS. But isn't also that people who have AIDS are immunosuppressed in a sense, their immune system isn't functioning, and then they would be more apt to get an infection like hepatitis C. Is that true as well or not?
Well, I mean, they're apt to get it if they're still taking part in unsafe behaviors. So I don't know that the immunosuppression itself makes them more likely to get it, but what it does do, when somebody comes in contact with hepatitis C, approximately 20% of people will fight it off, and 80% will develop chronic long-term infection. So if you're immunosuppressed with HIV or other reasons for immunosuppression, then it might be more like 95% of people, of the suppressed people, will get the chronic infection rather than 80%.
Right. Well, let's get on to specifically talking about what this recommendation is, because it's somewhat shocking because we have so many baby boomers in this country. I mean, you know, the baby boomers are like the pig and the python in terms of the large numbers that we have kind of moving through our system. And we've affected the health delivery and healthcare delivery at every stage. So tell us, first of all, what is the recommendation, Dr. Parr? What have they suggested, that everyone through this age range needs to have
that people get tested for hepatitis C? And the reason why is this group of people is at risk, and we'll talk about why they're at risk. But also, when one has hepatitis C infection, you're basically asymptomatic for the first 10 to 20 years.
Really?
And so you don't know it. So you wouldn't go to your doctor because you're feeling bad. So the thing to do is to screen asymptomatic people.
Okay, so let's start with the disease itself, hepatitis C. What is it, and what does it do to you? Yeah. What's infected?
Okay, so hepatitis, there is a virus, and there are a number of hepatitis viruses, A, B, C, D, E are the most common ones, but there are actually a few other ones. So hepatitis C is a virus. It's most commonly acquired by blood exposures that can occur in a variety of ways, and it goes to the liver.
So hepatitis is an infection of the liver?
Yes.
Okay. And you have different strains, as you said.
Yes, and there are different. So it's an infection of the liver. The word hepatitis is derived from the Greek word hepaticus, which means liver. So it goes to the liver.
And what does it do? What does hepatitis C specifically do to the liver?
What hepatitis C does, it causes inflammation in the liver, and eventually it destroys liver cells. When the liver cells are destroyed, they're replaced by fibrosis, which is essentially scar tissue. So the normal liver becomes destroyed and it gets replaced by the scar tissue. The scar tissue is non-functional, so eventually people are going to develop liver failure.
And what happens then? What does that
mean?
Well,
you know, so you have to understand what the liver does to understand liver failure. And very simply, the liver detoxifies or metabolizes all of the medications that we take, alcohol that we drink, other recreational drugs, it's going to metabolize. It also, all of the food that we eat passes through the liver, and the liver builds proteins. It helps to regulate the glucose, the sugar in your blood, either putting it out or storing it.
So it's basically, just to interrupt you a minute, it's the liver itself is essential for life.
It's essential for life.
You cannot live without a fully functioning liver.
Correct.
Right. When you say metabolizes all these things, it makes them available for the body to use.
Breaks them down so that the body can use them, yes.
Right.
Yes.
So if you have liver failure, you're at risk to die.
You're
at
risk to die, yes. And here's what happens. When people develop liver failure, their blood platelets go down, and they're at risk of bleeding. the protein in the blood goes down, and it's protein in the blood that holds the fluid part of blood inside of the blood vessels. So the fluid weeps out of the blood vessels, and people get ascites, which is a lot of fluid in the abdomen, and they get edema, which is a lot of fluid in the lower extremities.
So it's a pretty serious issue if your liver isn't functioning well.
Yes, and then the really serious thing is people get encephalopathy.
So the brain gets swollen.
The brain gets affected by all the toxins that are building up, and so people have to be admitted to the hospital for care to get them back into shape.
So it sounds like the baby boomers are most at risk. Why is that?
Well, you know, a lot of things, in our country happened as the baby boomers reached adolescence. We had our sexual revolution. People started experimenting with drugs and that sort of thing. So it's, and even a lot of the baby boomers, I mean, I have patients who I know today are professional and responsible, but they experimented with intravenous drugs. Intranasal cocaine is thought to transmit hepatitis C if you're using the same instrument to take the cocaine intranasally. And then the more sex partners you have also increases the risk of hepatitis C infection. So I think it was the cultural changes that occurred in our country, plus blood transfusions.
But now it sounds like, Kelly, help us with this. I understand that your AIDS Institute is playing a role, or your AIDS clinic here, is playing a role in helping people with hepatitis C. Tell us about how that works.
Yeah. We have a grant program to provide care for people who are HIV and hepatitis C infected. Several years ago, the State Department of Health realized that there were so many people who were infected, didn't know their status, and it's easier to treat people early on than when they're very sick. And so grants were made available, and we have one. So our program provides on-site mental health services. We have a substance abuse counselor, a nutritionist, and we also have peer supports, which is very important for the program. So our patients can talk one-on-one with a peer. We're working on getting a support group going so they can meet as a group. It's important to talk to somebody that's been through the treatment that knows what it's like, because there are some significant side effects.
There are to the treatment. I want to come back to this. So somewhat similar to AIDS, now that we do have this AIDS cocktail going on and it's more of a chronic disease, with Hep C, there are treatments available. It's a virus, but there are actual treatments available. Is that correct?
Yeah, there are treatments that are available that can actually cure the disease, unlike HIV, which we can control. But hepatitis C, we can cure. So the two mainstays right now of HIV treatment are drugs called ribavirin and interferon. Interferon is an injection that's given once per week.
You said of AIDS treatment. Do you mean AIDS?
Excuse me. I'm sorry. I do so much AIDS treatment.
Right, clearly.
That I sometimes forget but what I wanted I'm talking
to
about.
No, but I wanted to make sure that we were clear on this.
Yes.
So you're now talking about these two drugs are for
yes.
Hep C.
We're
Please
talking
go on.
About the Hep C drugs. Right. Interferon, which is an injection that can be given once a week, and then ribavirin, which are pills that are given every day. So we've been using those drugs for about 10 years now to treat hepatitis C, and overall, the cure rate was only 50%. Now, let me back up a minute. There are three common types of hepatitis C in the United States. Type 1 is the most common, and then there's type 2 and 3. So 2 and 3 are only treated with interferon and ribavirin. There's about an 80% cure rate for them, but there was, up until recently, less than a 50% cure rate for type 3. Now two new drugs are out on the market. One is called telaprevir, the other is called boceprevir. We have to give those drugs in combination with the interferon and the ribavirin, so they don't replace it. It's an add-on, and there are a lot of pills that need to be taken, but if we can treat the people with these medications for 6 months to a year, approximately 70% of them will have a cure.
Wow, that's incredible. So that is another strong motivator for people to go out and get tested.
Yes.
Because as you suggested, if you can have a disease that you don't know about for 20 years and then end up in liver failure, you might want to know about it in advance before you get to that advanced state.
Exactly. And you know, the individual, of course, wants to know about it, but, you know, the country as well. I mean, we're anticipating that, you know, over the next 50 years, the amount, billions of dollars, is going to be spent on taking care of people with cirrhosis and
which
who
is
need liver transplantation. Yes.
So in other words, this is also a public health concern.
Exactly.
On large scale, yes. We need to make sure we do more preventative or curing of people before they get to that advanced
mm-hmm.
stage.
Yes.
So where can people get the tests done? I mean, I know they're throwing out this large scale recommendation. Where do people go and get these kinds of tests done? And is it a simple blood test?
It is a blood test, and you can go to your primary care physician
right.
or any other medical provider, and they can order the test.
And then does it take a long time to get your results in terms of whether you have hepatitis C?
You know, I think that at most hospitals and labs, that's an overnight sort of test. I mean, you might even be able to get it in the morning and have the result back in the afternoon.
And then if you wanted... I mean, and this is generally covered by insurance? I mean, both the tests and the treatment, or is that something that you have to work out with your own individual relationship with your insurance company?
Insurance companies are getting more and more complicated to deal with, so it's taking a lot of time to get authorization to pay for the medications for our patients. We actually have a nurse and another staff person that they spend a good deal of their time working on getting the authorizations for the medication. Mm. So we have to jump through all kinds of hoops. We have to provide them with all kinds of lab results.
Welcome to America,
yeah.
to our health system.
But it's worth it in the end, and we put the effort into it because we want people to be treated.
And in your experience, have you seen, in your own experience, 70% cure rates for that type 1 that you were talking about?
Well, we've just started our co-infection clinic right now, so I don't think that we have enough patients I know we don't have enough patients and not even enough who are finished with their treatment. What I can say is that we're seeing very good results. People, you know, during the first 1 or 2 months of treatment, you can tell if people are going to have a good response, and so far people are having very good responses.
So I want to make it clear, though, you run a clinic for AIDS, and so people who have Hep C would have to be co-infected with AIDS to go to your clinic. But anyone out there, any baby boomer, needs to be checked for Hep C and to go to their own primary care physician, get the test, get the treatment, and go from there.
Correct.
Right? Well,
correct.
I want to thank you so much for coming in today and sharing that with us. My guests have been Dr. David Parr. He's an associate professor of medicine specializing in infectious diseases, and he's the medical director of the designated AIDS Center at Upstate, and Kelly Flood, a social worker, and also the assistant program director of the same clinic. Thanks so much for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Determination, focus, and disappointment, or my Achilles heel. Well, folks, in Greek mythology, Achilles was prophesied to live a life more glorious than that of his famed warrior father, Peleus, but to die young. To protect him from an early death and make him invulnerable, his mom, Thetis, submerged him in the magical river Styx, holding him by his heel, which wasn't touched by the water and not protected. Of course, Achilles' ambition drove him to heroism in the Trojan War, but was also his undoing, as he was shot in his heel with an arrow and killed. I've been determined to run a marathon this year. Now, marathons had something to do with the Trojan War, didn't they? Faster than my last one. Race date in about 6 weeks. I've been very focused on that goal, soldiering on through all the training runs while doing my very best to avoid overtraining, which has been my Achilles heel in the past, and led to various injuries that kept me from reaching my goal. And this year has been glorious, getting fitter and faster and no injuries. Until, as I wrote this, I'd just come from my physical therapist. I was sitting with my right heel in a bucket of ice water, with no kidding, a sprained Achilles tendon. How do I feel? Disappointed and sad. Despite our very best intentions, life does not often go how we hope, and then it's disappointing and sad. What can we do? Remember that we all have our weaknesses. Disappointment and defeat will come for all of us. But then, like my compassionate, understanding physical therapist, call on our compassion for ourselves and each other. We all have our Achilles heel. Compassion heals, along with a bucket of ice water. I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next, how weight loss telephone coaching can prevent diabetes. And please stay with us for a visit from the Healing Muse. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for September 30th. Talk it out. Although it can be hard to discuss stressful situations, keeping perspective and coming up with potential solutions is an important part of remaining calm and moving forward. Friends or coworkers who are often facing similar issues or have advice from past experiences can provide the perfect support system to help you do just that. If you feel stressed this week, ask friends or family to lend an ear. They may be able to offer insight that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Metabolic syndrome affects a third of United States adults and is associated with countless medical problems and even premature death. And it's often a precursor to diabetes and cardiac conditions as well. But now a new study has some hopeful and helpful news for these individuals, and here to tell us all about it is Dr. Paula Treif. She's professor of psychiatry and medicine and a senior associate dean for faculty affairs at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Treif. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So you've just completed a study conducted in cooperation with Upstate's Joslin Diabetes Center.
Right.
Tell us about it.
It's actually not quite complete. We're actually still collecting data for another few months. But this is a study that was based on a pretty well-known project called the Diabetes Prevention Program, or the DPP. And the DPP was a large trial, covered the whole country, where they worked with patients who had metabolic syndrome, who are people who are at risk for diabetes, and they worked with them to help them lose weight, to see if weight loss would lead to prevention of diabetes. They compared that to medication, essentially. And what they found was that the weight loss was more effective than medication in helping people prevent diabetes over a three-year period.
So you already knew those kinds of findings going into your study.
That's right.
So what was the goal of your particular study?
So when the DPP was done, it was done with a very select group of people, very tightly controlled research environment. And now a lot of us are doing studies looking at how can we take those results and translate them into the community and actually make them work with real people in a real setting. And so the goal of our study was twofold. One was to deliver the DPP by phone, because we know that it's really difficult for people to get into offices on a regular basis. If they're working or if they're disabled or live in a rural area, that their access to those kinds of interventions is kind of limited. So we delivered the DPP by phone. And we also wanted to build on the relationship that patients have with their primary care care providers. We know that primary care providers are very significant in helping people lose weight. They help them think about it. They help them know what they need to do. And so they have a relationship with them, usually a long-lasting relationship. So for something to work over a long period of time, they probably need that kind of a long-lasting relationship.
So it's already existing, a relationship, and trust and all of the other things.
Right.
And they understand all the different ramifications within that patient's life. And so that can play a role in how they advise them.
Yes.
So when you're talking about deliver the DPP,
yeah.
tell us what that means.
So the DPP was a 16-session class, essentially, and it covers the kinds of things that you would normally think of when you think of a weight loss class. There was nothing really magic about it. They worked on counting calories, counting fat grams, increasing activity, helping people not live a sedentary lifestyle. It was all about working to lose, for the DPP, it was 7% of your body weight through decreased caloric intake and increased activity.
So it was exercise and diet, basically.
Right. Exercise and diet.
And they found that actually was effective
yes.
in diabetes prevention.
Yes. That weight loss, that led to weight loss. What they did was they created the best weight loss program they thought they could based on all the research that says what works. For example, research says that if people keep track, log what they eat, that's one thing that
diaries.
Seems to really help them. That, right.
Food
so
diaries.
The DPP included food diaries. If people weigh themselves regularly, that helps seems to help them. So the DPP included that. So they created this kind of gold standard weight loss intervention and then delivered it in these 16 sessions.
But the difference in your study was, in the earlier studies, it was done in person.
Yes.
And now you were doing it via telephone.
Yes.
And that's a significant difference for
right.
the reasons that you mentioned.
Yes. And the other difference was that in the DPP, it was done one-to-one, face-to-face. And we wanted to, a lot of these translations where people are doing in the community are doing it in group settings because the assumption is that groups are more cost-effective and that maybe they're better. But nobody really has looked at that. So we also wanted to look at that. So we also compared an individual intervention, a patient just with an educator, to a group intervention.
Well, I want to get to what you found in just a minute, but tell us some more about who these people are or were that you chose for the study. When we talk about metabolic syndrome, I mean, it's been in the news. People talk about it all the time, and obviously it can lead to all kinds of cardiac problems. I understand things like, obviously, obesity. There's a certain amount of high blood fat, high blood pressure, and even high sugar levels, which
yes.
obviously could be precursor and
right.
can lead to all kinds of cardiac problems.
That's right.
So why did you choose this group of metabolic syndrome as opposed, for example, to people who were already diabetic?
In the DPP, the focus was people who were at risk for diabetes. And so we also wanted to look at people who were at risk. And people with metabolic syndrome, as you described, which is obesity plus one of these other conditions, are known to be at risk for diabetes. There is a large trial that's going on now called the Look-Ahead Trial, which is looking at whether weight loss affects complications and other outcomes for people with diabetes. It's just a different population.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Paula Treif. We're talking about a new study testing the effectiveness of telephone coaching for weight loss intervention for individuals with metabolic syndrome, actually pre-diabetics. So what did you find?
So my colleague, and this is Dr. Ruth Weinstock, she is the medical director of the Joslin Diabetes Center, and we are kind of co-investigators on this. And what we found was that, one, that it's feasible. We could do it by phone. We could do it in groups by phone. So those are basically conference calls, and that it worked. So we looked at people after 1 year, and after 1 year, both the group intervention and the individual intervention lost a significant amount of weight. We haven't looked at our other outcomes. We have other things that we're looking at too. But the really interesting part, we think, is that after 2 years, that the individual people in the individual intervention gradually started to regain, which is very commonly seen in weight loss trials, even in the DPP, that you lose weight initially, and then as time goes on, people slowly start to regain.
So it's almost like you're more highly motivated, perhaps, at the outset. Is that possible?
Yeah, it's honestly hard to know why.
Why? Yeah.
It's hard to know why.
You'd be speculating.
It's a very common finding, yeah. But what we found was that the people in the group who were doing this together actually continued to lose. So after 2 years, that gradual, not only did they not start to regain, but they continued to lose. So we think that's very exciting.
What's your hypothesis for that?
So our main assumption here is that it has to do, obviously, with the nature of the group. So in the group, one of the things that happens is that there's a lot of support for each other.
Just help us out. to understand exactly. Yeah. This is on the telephone.
This is on the telephone.
So this is conference calling?
A conference call, yeah.
So everybody can hear everybody else. So it's kind of like a group over the phone.
Exactly. That's exactly right. There's an educator, and there's up to 8 people, although most of the groups were 4 to 5. And the so they're supporting each other. They're saying, oh, good for you, Sally. You did really great. So there's that kind of emotional support. They also give each other advice, a lot of advice that the educator really has a script that she's following, and these are the things that she's trying to teach. But they'll say things like, oh, I tried this new low-fat cheese. It was really terrific. Or there's a store that sells this food that I thought was really great. Or this is how I got exercise into my life. So they not only support each other, but they provide hints, I think, helpful
useful
hints.
Information. Yeah. It's, you know, we have models for all of this. I mean, obviously, AA is
That's a classic one.
But there have been models throughout all kinds of medical
Think of Weight Watchers, all those group settings. But what was exciting, we thought, was that really no one has demonstrated that group is not only as effective, but maybe more effective in the long run.
So these were all adults.
Yes.
Is that correct? Is there any thought about doing this kind of thing? Obviously, with the rate of obesity growing amongst children, is there any thought to doing something like this with children as well?
Yeah. Well, actually, both Dr. Weinstock and I were involved in another trial called the TODAY trial, which is with youth who have diabetes, youth who have type 2 diabetes, which is still a pretty rare event, but growing. And that was around weight loss and medication as well. In that case, the weight loss actually was not, the intervention wasn't successful in weight loss, and it wasn't as helpful as the medication. There are other groups that are studying kids, working with kids who are not diabetic but are obese and helping them lose weight. There's a lot of those kinds of studies.
Yeah, very important, especially with the growth of diabetes in our community and all, I mean, in our country and all of the sequelae, all the problems that follow from being diabetic.
That's right. And if you have those problems when you're, you know, 11, you have many more years ahead of you to develop the complications and have the difficulties. And they're finding with the kids with type 2 that they're developing complications at a faster rate.
Wow.
It seems like it's a more aggressive disease process. It's just beginning to look at that.
Yeah, well, also, isn't it pretty new that we've had that many young diabetics?
Yes, type 2. That's right. It's very new.
So how did you pick your first of all, how many subjects were there?
We had, I think it was 267 or something like that. Mm-hmm. We actually had 5 practice sites, 3 more rural sites in Oneida and other areas, and then 2 sites in Syracuse, urban, the university, our own University Healthcare Center and the Syracuse Neighborhood Health
Center.
And
that was also as a way of trying to just kind of, it was a random notion of seeing.
Yes, we didn't want to just have one group. We wanted to see, you know, our assumption here is that the phone is really good for helping people in rural areas, as I said, so we wanted to reach out to rural areas, that it was helpful in reaching out to the poor and underserved because they might not be able to get into settings, so we wanted to reach out to them as well. So we wanted to broadly reach people.
Also, it sounded to me like one of the things that stood out to me was not only that the telephone was an effective way of reaching all these individuals who might otherwise not be able to come to sessions, but also by using a primary care people as opposed to diabetic counselors, perhaps, mm-hmm. could be more cost-effective. And as you said, also within their normal course of care.
Yeah, we actually do have someone looking at cost effectiveness. We don't have that data yet, so we don't really know. That's our assumption as well, because the educators who were identified at the sites were mostly LPNs. I think we had one nurse practitioner, and we had one medical office assistant, so there was a range of their own expertise. We had to train them in delivering it. We supervised them as well. They talked to each other, some to provide some support as they went along. So we're also hoping that it helps us with sustainability, so that we do this intervention for a few years. That now we're studying, there's one more year where we're looking at what happens when we pull out. Do the practices continue the intervention or not? And so if they have someone who's trained to do this, who's committed to doing it, do they still offer it or not? Or is it something that, you know, we come in as kind of university experts and then we leave and it disappears? That won't be good either.
Because as you said in the beginning, the whole point was to try to see how all of this prevention work could actually be translated into the real world.
That's right.
And that's really crucial. I think that's very critical, because it strikes me that so many people in primary care are being asked to do so many things these days. It reminds me almost of the analogous situation of the public school. The public school is the place where now everything is being done, you know, diet and mental health services and social services of all kinds. Well, the primary care physician is also being asked to do all of these things for all their patients. And even though clearly something like this, if it is effective, could, you know, help people in the, you know, over time in a very significant way, the onus falls on the primary care provider.
Yeah, actually, that was that's a good point, and that was one of the reasons we did not decide to go to the physician themselves and work with them. And there are interventions where they do that; they try to work with the physicians, but it's just too much, almost, as you said. And so our thinking was, if you can train people who are
mid-level providers,
or even, as I said, one person was a
medical assistant,
that group was actually our most successful group.
Wow. Well, in the little bit of time we have left, are you hoping to do anything further with this? I mean, do you have follow-up studies in mind?
Yes. Well, we're certainly hoping to. We also want to see, as I said, what happens after we pull out and what goes on there. We are talking with some people about how we can kind of spread the intervention and not just test it in a research model, but actually
provide it as a model.
And provide it as a model and offer it to primary care practices, perhaps, to train their staff or to oversee the process. So we're just starting to talk about that now.
Yeah, I think obviously reimbursement is going to be a big factor
right.
as to whether they can actually follow through on that, but that's
right.
for the future. And
that's
I
right.
want to thank you so much. It's very interesting information.
Okay.
My guest has been Dr. Paula Treif, Professor of Psychiatry and Medicine at Upstate Medical University.
Thank you.
You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate's literary journal, The Healing Muse. Today we're going to do a segment, a poem called Hip Precautions, by a professor of medicine from UCAL at Irvine. Her name is Johanna Shapiro, and she's talking about something that all of us can relate to in the baby boomer generation. When you get your new hip, or you get your new whatever, we are the organ generation that's being replaced here very well. Hip Precautions is a very funny poem. If you read the poem, you will see that she has actual instructions from her physician when she got her hip replaced. And what she's done is fill in the blanks in between them. This is a rousing call to action for all of us baby boomers who are close to retirement. She's warning us, don't stop living. Okay, Hip Precautions by Johanna Shapiro. Fellow oldsters, you know what I'm talking about when we get those fabulous, spanking new metal and ceramic balls and sockets. We want to protect our investment of money, pain, blood, sweat, tears. So we take precautions. Hip precautions. How hip is that? You remember the hipsters, don't you? The Beat Generation. Wild, free, on the road. Maybe you even were a hipster before you got lost in the American dream and started driving that RV all over nowhere. Oldsters, these hip precautions? Come on, Grandma. Really think about them for a sec. Don't bend too far. As in, get some backbone, Granny. Show some spine, Gramps. Stand up for something you believe in. Stop the war. That one still works. Save the environment. Whatever. Just do something that matters with that new hip. Don't cross your legs or your principles. Use these years to do what you've always known is right, but always seemed too unconventional, too radical. Set a trend that goes deeper than fashion. Set a trend that someone will remember after you are gone. Don't stand pigeon-toed. It's a posture of shame. You big dodos, be proud that you have made it to body part replacement time and decide that new hip can bear the weight of the world, its poverty, its violence, its still burgeoning promise. Don't twist and turn, parsing your words with a politician's precision. Admit your mistakes. You can start with Iraq, work your way down to the kids, and whether you really tithe enough to your church. Use that hip to take a stand. Oldsters, be hip, be cool, be finger-popping mellow. Heck, smoke a little weed if you want, but remember who you are and who you still can be, so that when that titanium prosthesis heals, you can use it to walk somewhere that is worth walking to.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's Health Link on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we learn how to improve the immunization rates for kids in this country. Plus, we'll explore what it means to have compassionate rounds for healthcare providers and the powerful impact that these can have. You can find out more about Upstate's literary journal, The Healing Muse, by going to our website. And if you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it also on our website. That's HealthLink, all one word, .org. And if you'd like to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.